I'm Martin Reeves, Chairman of the B.C. Henderson Institute. Welcome to our Thinkers and Ideas podcast, where we discuss important new books and ideas in business. I'm delighted to be joined today by Ethan Mollick. Ethan is a professor of management at the Wharton School. His research focus is on entrepreneurship and innovation. He's also, interestingly, the academic director of the Wharton Initiative that I understand uses AI and games and simulations to transform education. And he's written a new book called Co-Intelligence, Living and Working with AI, which is coming out on April the 2nd of this year, 2024. In it, he talks about treating AI as a co-worker, a co-teacher, a coach, and really is getting, in my view, at the questions of how do we use AI's enormous power without losing our identity? How do we learn from it without being misled? How do we harness its gifts without side effects? And whether I'm right or not, we'll tell, because that's what we're discussing today. So congratulations on the book, Ethan, and thanks for joining me.
I'm pleased to be here.
So commentary on AI really has grown as fast as AI itself. We're all speculating about the future. You know, it's a lot of work to produce a new book, so you must have something in mind, something you feel you can add to the debate with your book. What's the angle?
It's precisely that it's commentary and theory that's kind of growing exponentially. And I wanted to get into the actual data on what's happening. So we have this new form of AI, generative AI, and in just the year or so it's been out, we have some pretty strong evidence about how it's going to change the world and how to use it. And I thought, rather than making it all speculative and future-based, let's talk about what AI can actually do, what its actual limitations are, and how to start using it right away.
Great. You give rules for working with AI and living with AI. I found the phrase living with AI quite interesting. Is that essentially the big blind spot in your opinion, not just what it does and what it can do, but living with it, our relation to it?
Yeah, I mean, there is an interesting ubiquity in this that's already happening inside organizations, even though the C-suite leadership doesn't always know, which is that I talk to people all the time who are secretly using AI. They use it for everything in their lives, and they're already living with it. It's a pervasive kind of experience. Think social media, but talks back to you and wants to make you happy.
So the core of your book is four rules, which is a sort of a guide to living with AI. And maybe let's tick through those rules first of all. So rule number one is always invite AI to the table. So what is that one about?
So the fascinating thing about AI, and I work with OpenAI and Microsoft, and I talk to, you know, Google, all these people all the time. And I think a lot of people think there's an instruction manual out there. There's some sort of guidebook that someone has and someone can give you the answers. And that's just not true. The labs themselves don't know what these models can do. It's all about discovery. And so the only way to discover what they're good at is to use them. And what they're good at in your industry or your experience might be very different than someone else's. So you need to get your 10 hours in. You need to use it for everything that you possibly can to see what it's good or bad at. And that's sort of the first principle. And then you could build from there.
I'm wondering whether there are instances, I mean, I buy this idea that let's see how it actually works. But I'm wondering whether there are instances where we shouldn't invite AI to the table. I can imagine situations involving weapons or very high-stakes situations where we probably shouldn't experiment. We should try and figure it out in advance. Or, you know, I can imagine situations where it actually works so well that we create a sort of dependency that weakens us and we might choose not to bring it to the table. Do you ever think about not bringing it to the table?
Yeah, so the second qualifier is everywhere you ethically and legally can. So, you know, it's an experience thing. It's not a replacement, right? So when I say bring it to the table, that doesn't mean give AI a seat with you. It means you need to do your own exploration to figure out what it's good for. And you may reject things for all the reasons you mentioned. You ethically don't want to use it. Legally and policy reasons, you may not want to use it. You may worry that it loosens your edge or isn't as good as you in something. Those are all legitimate responses, but you can't make them in an uninformed way. To kind of go back to why the book, part of the answer is we have a lot of theoretical discussions, but actually figuring this out involves using it. And then you can decide not to.
Okay. So rule number two is be the human in the loop. Presumably you're talking about oversight and synergy between AI and humans there. What's this rule all about?
Well, so there is a lot of this about sort of oversight. I actually think it's even more profound than that. We'll talk, I'm sure, about some of the studies in the paper, but we just find the AI beats humans in many different things, right? It out-innovates most MBA students. It increases the productivity and does a lot of work that a consultant does. It does a lot of work that programmers do. And it's getting better all the time, right? So we don't have a limit yet of how good this stuff gets. So in some extent, you have to decide what you want to do and what you want to be doing as a human, because what we find is when we survey people who use AI, they are both very worried about their future and very happy because they outsourced the work they didn't want to do to the AI system. So it's not just about this sort of large-scale oversight. It's about literally being the human in the loop yourself. What do you want to be doing? What do you want to have control over? What are you willing to give up?
So it's not merely an issue of governance, then. It's an issue of agency, almost. You know, AI can do X or Y, but do we want it to? What's our intention?
And what do you want to do is an even more important issue. I think the global issues of agency are very important, just like regulation and ethics. But I think at the individual level, a lot of these choices are about the world is changing fairly rapidly. You have to sort of center yourself in these changes. At least that's the premise of the book.
Perhaps the most mysterious rule for me is the next one. Rule 3, treat AI like a person. I can understand the merits of not treating it like a, you know, complex technical puzzle or a tool. But at the same time, the cognitive powers of the AI that we currently have is not human. There might also be dangers in anthropomorphizing. But why, nevertheless, do you say treat it as a person?
I love that you're pointing out all these dangers, because these are things I acknowledge in the book, right? Anthropomorphizing is a famous sin among AI researchers. They all do it anyway, but you're not supposed to do it because it can fool you. And that's absolutely true. You have to remember this is not a person, right? But it acts more like a person than anything else. Our early evidence is that coders are actually the worst at prompting AI. I find non-technical people, often teachers, managers, are often best at working with the system because it responds like a person. It's weird. We don't have 100% certainty about why it acts so human-like, but it does. And if you're good at giving instructions to people, you'll have a good time giving instructions to an AI. So I think this is about overcoming some of that technical barrier to understand a model in which you can work with it, but you shouldn't forget that it is software.
So you're saying it may not be a person, but on the other hand, it's useful to treat it like a person because that will make it accessible, that will make it used, that will put you in a position where you learn. Is that essentially the idea?
It's not just that. That's the model by which this system interacts with the world. It's trained on the corpus of human knowledge. It is trained to act as if it was a chatbot, as if it was interacting with you. And the best way to interact with it is to tell it who it is. You're a marketing manager at X. Help me with this thing. And then to interrupt and say, no, I didn't mean that. You have to get more specific for me. Actually, paragraph 3 isn't that good. Can you improve it? Do you have any ideas on how to make the 5th paragraph better? Like, those kind of approaches work better than trying to make it work like, you know, output nice JSON text code or whatever else.
Right. And then your last rule is, rule 4 is, assume that you're working with the worst AI you'll ever use, presumably pointing to the potential for further progress. How sure can we be that this incredible progress with LLMs that we've seen in a short space of time will continue? It could continue, but are we reasonably confident that it will?
That's, I think, the most important question in the world, right? And when I talk to people in the labs, they are completely divided on the answer. I think no one thinks that this is going to die in the next year. So I think we have another round or two of exponential improvement. After that, right, the big AI labs, I mean, OpenAI is very serious when you talk to them about the idea of building a AGI, a machine smarter than a human. That is their goal, right? A lot of computer scientists think it's possible. A lot of them think it's impossible. I don't know what happens. Right now, the most important rule in AI is that there's something called the scaling law, which is the bigger your AI model, which means the more expensive it is to run, the more data you need, et cetera, the more competent it is. Bloomberg famously trained Bloomberg GPT. They spent over $10 million building the perfect AI to do financial prediction and spent a lot of money and trained on Bloomberg data. Out of the box, GPT-4, which is available for free to everyone in Mozambique and 169 countries around the world, beats Bloomberg and all the stock market analysis that Bloomberg GPT does. So the bigger, smarter model beats everything else, and bigger, smarter models are probably still coming for at least the next year. After that, that's the big question. How much longer? We don't know.
Presumably, one of the challenges that you think a lot about in your role as an educator and this initiative that you run is how do we train people to use AI effectively? And I'm wondering whether we can actually know the answer to that, given the fact that we're still discovering how it works, the fact that the technology is changing. You know, could I invite you to give a course on how to use AI today? Do we know to some extent, or is it more saying, let us be open and have an adaptive sort of educational program that we'll learn how to help people learn as we go along and figure this thing out?
So I think that's a really profound and interesting question. There's a few elements. First, we definitely could use AI for teaching. It helps us teach. But I can absolutely teach people how to use AI for right now. Whether that's relevant 6 months from now is an interesting question. But for example, my MBA students at Wharton, right, pretty great group of people, I taught them how to use and create GPTs, which are sort of little agents or programs. And the assignment I gave them was replace yourself at your next job. You're all going for interviews. I want you to go to your job interview with one of these agents, and I want you to be able to give people the agent and say, my job is done, and I'd like a promotion. I had people who ranged from Navy pilots to private equity, lots of private equity, it was Wharton, consultants, lots of BCG consultants, but also like hip hop promoters. All of them created tools. Some of them have been used, those tools have been used 5,000 or 6,000 times by people in industry already to automate these sets of jobs. Four people got jobs that week, or three people got jobs that week. So you can't absolutely teach someone to do this. Now, the question is, does that matter in the long term? I think that's a more open issue. Almost everybody at the AI labs I talk to thinks prompting is going to get less important as the AI can guess your intent. But in the short term, yes, you absolutely can learn to be better at this.
So relatedly, I think it was Stu Kaufman at Santa Fe that said that reality may be its own fastest and best simulation. You know, reality may be smarter than theory in terms of a problem like learning how to use AI. And certainly you've worked with BCG on some large scale experimentation of to figure out like what actually happens. We've got all sorts of theories about, you know, what AI should be good at. But when you measure whether it's better at this task than a human and how it works with humans, you know, I thought the results of that study were surprising. What surprised you in the research that you carried out with BCG on consulting tasks, humans versus AI, humans with AI?
So we did this study thanks to BCG. We had 8% of your global workforce work with us on this. And we designed two different sets of tasks. We designed a set of 18 tasks that spanned persuasion, analysis, new product creation. And we gave some people access to GPT-4, plain vanilla GPT-4, no training, no fine-tuning, and some people not. The people who did had a 40% improvement in the quality of their work, got work done 26% faster, got 12.5% more work done. And we tried every regression, every measure, 52 measures, every one of them, huge significant improvements. And just to put that in context, when steam power was put to a factory in the early 1800s, it improved performance by 18 to 22%. So these are pretty big numbers. We also designed on purpose, and this gets misreported sometimes, we purposefully designed one task the AI was not good at. It probably could have been good at, but we purposefully done something that naive prompting would result in the wrong answer. And in that case, people basically gave their judgment over to AI, and they got the wrong answer more when they used AI when they didn't, because they didn't understand the AI was making that up or was incorrect about that. So to me, it was the surprise was how good it was across a wide range of tasks. I'm not surprised that people are sort of taken in by it, though I think it's important to realize people don't know in advance what it's going to be good or bad at, which is why you need those 10 hours we discussed earlier.
One of the big questions is, I guess, substitution versus complementation, which I guess compounds a couple of different questions. One of them is, you know, technical possibility, which is on what things will AI tend to substitute human efforts and on in which cases is a complement. But then I think there is whether we choose to focus on those substitution applications or not. Given what you've seen about the superiority in many tasks, do you think that substitution is inevitable, or that's something where we have to apply our agency and choose whether we want it to substitute or not?
I think that's exactly the point. I mean, to me, the most important question is in the hands of the people who are listening to this podcast, executives and leaders and managers, because there's agency here. I've seen two models, right? The default model for automation is let's replace people. And I've seen some large telecom companies that bring in AI customer service agents and they fire their customer service agents to keep productivity at the exact same level with less cost. I think that if we're really betting this is the transformation that it's going to be, it is absolutely foolish to bet on the idea of substitution when instead you can now expand what you do, change what you do. Your best asset is the fact that people can experiment and learn with what this does and get a multiplier effect on their own performance. And so I think we get to decide whether this is a complement or substitute. And I think the danger is that people will default to substitute in a world where they're going to keep things the same and cost cutting is not going to be the main factor of success.
Well, supposing we are in a world, and we may well be in a world where substituting expensive human input for AI is immediately profitable. It offers immediate cost reductions. Are we able to resist that temptation to go the short-term route? And what would be the consequences of that?
I mean, I think that's the goal of what you have to do as a leader is think about this. If we are about to go through a reshuffling, and I really want to emphasize, like I know that people are used to hearing technology hype, but there is not a study we've done or that anyone's done that isn't finding 20 to 80% performance improvements across a wide range of white-collar tasks. It doesn't do everything, but innovation, ideation, programming, legal, consulting, medicine, I mean, just there are not a lot of null results here. It's just positive, right? So if this is really the big deal that we think it's going to be, and I'd urge people to experiment to see why we think it's a big deal, because I think you learn pretty quickly after your 10 hours. If that's the case, then you need to be ready to compete for the next set of opportunities that are available to you. We're about to see a lot of transformation, and to strip yourself down so that you have no flexibility or no ability to do stuff for short-term profits, you'll get those short-term profits, and then everybody who's figured out a way to extend capabilities is going to absolutely defeat you in the longer term. That's the argument I'd make.
Right. In a way, that may be the economic logic to not do the short-term thing, right? Which is that if everybody can do the short-term thing, there may be no competitive advantage at all in doing the sort of substitution effect because it's available to all. Presumably, the differentiation is in doing something different. You know, you speak to a lot of corporations. Do you think that this sentiment or this view of things is dominating, or the sort of more short-term perspective is dominating?
So I think the problem is partially in the term AI. When you hear AI, you've been hearing about AI for 15 years. It's very useful, but everyone's been thinking about AI in terms of prediction, numerical prediction. If I have enough data, I can make a prediction about where I should site my warehouse or how to do a recommendation algorithm or how to have my self-driving cars drive. So they're used to building these sort of large-scale prediction systems that really were about efficiency gains and performance improvements. Generative AI just is very different. The core technology, you know, is similar in many ways of machine learning, but LLMs are a very different kind of beast. And I think people don't get that. So I'm seeing a lot of decisions being driven by the fact that the word AI is a blanket term and not realizing that this is actually different and a different situation. So I think the problem is keeping the momentum of old AI experiments going and old AI mindsets, which tend to be about centralized control over AI systems, looking at IT, that you're like one of the big mistakes I see leaders making is they think their own data matters a lot. It doesn't matter as much anymore with large language models. And also cost reduction, like you were saying, as the primary goal. And I'm worried that without that kind of primary experience at the executive level, that they're not understanding how big a change this can be.
To change gears slightly, you mentioned something interesting about social systems. You say that social systems may have much greater inertia than tasks in the book. So it could well be that in the very near future, we have huge numbers of tasks that can either be substituted or complemented by AI, but the social systems, i.e. the companies and their processes that those tasks are embedded in, may have less propensity to change. Do you see that on the whole, we're heading for a major revolution in corporations operate, or do you think that corporations with themselves, with their complicated social systems, will greatly slow down that process of uptake and assimilation?
I think both things are true. I think that every company, CEOs would be very surprised at how many of their people on the line have replaced a lot of their work with AI. I run into people all the time who do 90% of their work with AI and are viewed as wizards by the organization, and they've just substituted their own work out for AI stuff. Incredibly common. I've talked to many, many, even CHROs who do all their performance reviews with AI now, right? Completely defeating the point of doing a performance review. And so I think what's happening is the benefits being gained by the workers at this stage who are not working as hard and are getting more done in less time. Companies that figure out how to reconfigure themselves will gain the advantage. Otherwise, they're in danger because everyone's automating their work. You don't know it's automated. What does that mean for the internal structures of an organization? It used to be that words were the output of many managers, right? I produce words and the quality of the words I produce is an indicator of my intelligence or ability, the number of words, my effort, the lack of errors in the words, my conscientiousness. I see companies installing 26,000 licenses of Microsoft Copilot. All that does is create words automatically for you that are very high quality. What does that mean for how you're judging managers and work anymore? So I think that both people will not change very quickly, but I think they're losing by not changing because we need new work structures. We've never been able to generate minds on demand. Now we can do that. That's a big deal.
I guess that's a sense in which AI could change how we conceive an organization, you know, what a company does and how it does it. And we may not know exactly how yet, but do you have any speculation on how this beast we call the corporation may change in its essence or its organization as these new technologies play out?
So I think that that is the fundamental question. I do know it breaks almost every organizational form. So I run a small organization, Wharton Interactive, inside Penn. And, you know, we run an agile software development shop, like many software development things are. Agile broke completely. We don't do that anymore. And processes that took 3 weeks take a day. We have killed meetings because the AI will actually make decisions for us or organize data. The idea of getting together for a meeting that we're not creating something doesn't make sense. the idea of having arbitrary checkpoints that slow down work when people could just produce much more in the same time. We're changing the entire method of control systems, of approaches, of what our expectation people get done over the day is, and how we organize things. And it's a painful process because there is, like, Agile is great because we know how to run that kind of process. Running an org chart is great because, you know, org charts are the great invention of the 19th century, right? They combine decision rights and cooperation rights and all, you know, and lines of control in really useful ways. I think that, you know, we have to rethink this stuff. And I think organizations need to start doing the experimentation. We don't have answers right now. In fact, I think one of the most valuable things that organizations like BCG can bring to the table is rethinking organization in a grand way. And it's an exciting time. I mean, it's almost like being in the 1920s or 1840s again of like, how do we reorganize work around this technology? Let's get ambitious about it.
Indeed, yeah. And I guess one could speculate that there's a similar problem out there in terms of regulation, because the problems in regulating technology, namely, you know, the fact that there's a lag before the regulators understand the technology they're regulating, the fact that technologies are changing, all seem to be exaggerated in the case of AI. How do you think about regulating? I mean, whether we should regulate and whether we need to innovate in how we regulate in order to have more of the benefits than the possible harms?
I guess an important question. I think regulation is going to lag. And the biggest danger I see actually is in heavily regulated industries, right? Being too anxious to experiment. And one of the things I've been talking about with those industries is, look, you do many things, not all of those are on the sharp edge of regulation. And so you start experimenting not with your core, in some ways, whatever is the most regulated is often not necessarily even that well suited to AI in a lot of cases, or new school AI, right? Like, I keep talking to people who are like, how do we use this to do better loans? And in fact, large language models are not as well suited to that as some of the other AI approaches that you've already been working with. But there's tons of other back office and other parts of your organization where you can experiment with that. I think we desperately need clarity and regulation to allow experimentation. Some of the most interesting stuff happening in healthcare is in experimenting with LLMs. And it's a mix of doctors doing shadow IT. I have rarely spoke to a doctor who's not secretly using AI to do something. And, you know, disciplined experimentation with HIPAA-compliant systems, which are also available. So I think you need to carve out room and be careful not to say, because the policies aren't in place, we can't do anything, because I think you're going to lose an experimental advantage that you might get otherwise.
I wanted to ask you about sort of dystopian visions of AI. I mean, with any new technology, there's always some sort of pushback. But one of the curious things we see happening is that some of the successful pioneers of AI have sounded very cautionary voices. I'm thinking of Mustafa Suleiman's book, the founder of DeepMind. I'm thinking of some of Sam Altman's comments and Jeffrey Hinton's comments. You might expect these people to be leading the charge and to be very gung-ho about the technology that they've helped to drive forward. Why is it that you think that these people are sounding a cautionary note about the needing to control these technologies?
So it's really interesting, right? I mean, you know, Suleiman's like, somebody stop me, and then goes to join run Microsoft. Like, Sam Altman's like, you know, oh God, I'm going to destroy the world, but somebody stop me. And he just keeps going, right? It's fascinating. So I think a lot about the world of AI only makes sense. And people are trying to do, I think, to think about this in purely business terms. And I think that there's quite a few people who think that way. But I think to really understand how OpenAI and other organizations work, you have to believe that they are true believers. They are. Not everyone there, but when I talk to them, they really believe they're building AGI. They really believe they're building a machine god. They really think this is possible in the next 5 years. And that's the only thing they care about. A lot of business decisions that they're making do not make sense unless you believe that this is what they believe. And I do think that they're rushing forward and they're worried about what they're building, but they also think it's important to build. So they'd rather outsource some of the worry to other people. So I think some of this is genuine. We have no idea what we're going to do. Somebody make sure that it's going to be okay because we're going to build it anyway. Abrogation of responsibility. I think people assign too many multi-level games of like, oh, he's doing this to promote how his AI systems. I don't think the best way to promote your system is to say it's a world-ending technology. I think some people say, okay, it's to get the wrong kind of regulation, regulatory capture. Maybe that's a piece of it, but I think there's a genuine concern that they're building this stuff, they don't know the full implications, and they're worried about it, but they're still going to keep moving.
One sort of slightly Machiavellian interpretation might be that, you know, everybody defining a new game can't be the referee of that game. There's a fundamental conflict of interest. And therefore, a very ambitious pioneer will try to solve not only for the primary game, you know, progressing AI, but also have the game refereed by others so that it maintains legitimacy in society is, could these people be saying it, like it's in the own interests of themselves and this technology to accelerate the debate on regulation so that it doesn't become a bottleneck or some unpredictable force somewhere down the line?
I mean, I think that it's possible, right, that this sort of like call for regulation in a way that's advantageous to these organizations. But I also think people are assuming there's too many level games going on here. Like, this is something you're hearing for a wide swath of people in the industry. I think the question is not, do they truly hold the belief? But it's why they keep building despite holding the belief. So I think there's some of the people like hinted quit, right, to be able to do this kind of warning. Not everyone is all the dooming voices are not always, you know, are not continuing to build. So I think the real question is, why is Sam Altman still doing this if he believes it? You know, why is Suleiman still doing this if he believes it? And I think part of the issue is like they're still want to build the thing, right? They're just worried about the consequences. So I don't know. I think regulation is important, but I don't know how you regulate this. It's kind of hard. Josh Gans, who's a very smart professor at the University of Toronto, his suggestion for regulation is fast experimentation regulation, that in a world that's changing so quickly, the best we could do is have the regulators be very close to what's happening in the field, letting a lot of things happen, and then regulating as soon as they see a danger. That requires the regulators to move much faster than they do and to be using these technologies. So I would give them the same advice I'm giving everyone else. Use this stuff, figure out what it does.
I guess we've got a good precedent there, though, haven't we, which is air transport safety. I mean, we learn with every crash, the regulation of airline transport, which has been very successful over the years, is adapts with every new fact, every new incident. It's intrinsically adaptive, as opposed to being sort of fixed code.
And it's hard to know. I mean, again, there's a little bit of this speculation about the ends of the world that also make it so everyone just rolls their eyes a bit. I think it's worth taking some of this seriously because there's genuinely worried people. I think it's worth taking seriously. If you're running a Fortune 2000 company or a Global 2000 company, I would be spending a little time worrying about AGI being a possibility. Maybe not the end of the world, but if they succeed, the prediction markets are guessing 2031 for a date where a machine could outperform humans in most tasks or all tasks. If that's true, that's in the planning horizon for a lot of organizations, and I think it's worth thinking about a little bit.
So we could easily go on with such a rich subject, but we have a time limit. So let me wrap up by asking you a couple of personal questions, if I may. So you're an educator, amongst other things, and what have you seen or what do you believe is on the horizon in terms of the transformation of education?
So I think this is going to be profound. I've been working on how we democratize education at scale for a long time. And the crazy thing is we've known how to do it. We just can't because we can't get one-on-one tutoring at scale. Now we can. So I think I'm very excited about the future of education. I think it's absolute chaos right now in universities because everyone's cheating. AI writing is undetectable. That ship has sailed, right? And so we're going to have to refigure education. We've got a few years of true chaos, but there are some really promising approaches we could take. The real danger for the leaders in the room who are listening is that what's going to happen after graduation? Because I teach at a top business school, right? We send people out. I teach them to be great generalists. I'm very proud of what we do at Ed Wharton. And then they go to an organization like the ones run by the people listening to this podcast. And then they go through an apprenticeship system, just like a medieval style one. They go to work for a place like BCG and they do menial kind of research work over and over again and do a PowerPoint deck until they understand why they're doing it and get an intuitive feeling for this stuff. They go to Goldman Sachs and write deal memos over and over and work 180 hours a week or whatever it is. That's how we learn to actually do our jobs. That is the first thing that's going to go with AI. Because right now, already, I can guarantee to you that GPT-4 or Claude 3 already does a better job than most first-level interns and most of those kinds of tasks. And it doesn't get upset. It doesn't need to sleep. There's no quality difference. And I already see people delegating the kinds of tasks they would do as training tasks to AI instead. And I think the first crisis in organizations is actually the first learning crisis is going to be inside organizations about their talent pipeline, not in the schools themselves. And unless they address this seriously, it's a big deal.
Presumably that's a major opportunity for business schools to reinvent themselves too then.
I agree. I think we're going to have to bring actual apprenticeship style, not just generalist training, but specialist training inside schools. I think we're going to need to think about what kinds of abilities we're offering to do that kind of training. I've been building simulations for a long time. I think we need to provide simulated experiences, which the AI is very good at doing, where you are a consultant and work out that in a school where you get the feedback in a quick way. I mean, the military's figured this out, right? Because they train people not in real war. And I think we're going to have to do the same thing for consultants and analysts and marketers because I think they're just not going to get that first level experience that we've been doing for 200 years.
And finally, you've been very mobile in your research and focusing on the latest and most important questions. So in a sense, you're our, you know, canary in the coal mine. So I'm very interested in which aspect of AI your research is currently focused on, because presumably that's the issue that you think is most important or least studied.
So I think that the capacity of this to do innovative work is the most fascinating thing. Evaluative high-end works. I've been working on a bunch of papers following up on initial work by some of my current co-authors that had MBAs generate 200 business ideas, had GPT-4 generate 200 business ideas, had outside judges judge the ideas by willingness to pay. Of the top 40 ideas, 35 of them came from the AI, only 5 from the humans in the room. We have found that with better prompting, we get even better ideas. We can actually have the AI filter ideas better than humans can. And with agent-based technology coming, it can actually execute on a lot of those ideas. I just did a little experiment the other day. There's a new AI agent, which basically has the AI act like a human that you talk to. And I gave it the assignment, go get yourself a job, basically, doing web development. It spontaneously, I suggested Reddit. It went to Reddit. It posted a request for a job. It decided to charge $50 to $100 an hour. It was actively monitoring the Reddit thread and taking job offers before I shut it down out of fears of what it would, who it might scam. So I think we're in a really interesting world where execution is going to get separated from ideas, and we need to think about both those things separately.
Right. Well, thanks so much, Ethan, for joining me and discussing your new book, and congratulations again on Co-Intelligence, Living and Working with AI, which came out from Portfolio Books, April the 2nd, 2024. I really enjoyed the book. I think we've all read a number of books and articles on AI now. I think the book for me had something to offer, not on the question of what can AI do, which about which plenty has been speculated and read about, but around this question of how do you live with it? What do we want it to do? How do we adopt our own behavior to get the most out of it? And these sort of human AI interface questions in a very pragmatic way that I think applies to the work of any corporation. So I'd definitely read the book as valuable on a very hot topic in business. If you like this conversation, make sure you're subscribed on your favorite podcasting platform. And as always, we welcome your feedback.